And let's go from political dramas to the dramas of daytime TV. When the soap opera One Life to Live went off the air this year, it didn't die off for some soap opera reason, killed by an evil twin brother. And its demise was not fake either, explained away later as a dream. It was part of a real decline of shows that once dominated daytime TV. NPR's Netta Ulaby reports on one of the last few survivors, Days of Our Lives.
It cannot hurt to have such an iconic theme.
Like sands through the hourglass, so are the days of our lives.
Soap operas are fighting for their lives. Days of Our Lives has been through almost as much as Molly Burnett. She plays a reformed vixen on the show named Melanie.
I've been shot, stabbed, poisoned by a wedding hairpiece. I was shot by my mom on my wedding day. I found out my husband cheated on me with my father. I didn't know I had wife. And then they had a child.
You thought it was okay that my husband slept with my father's
wife? I didn't
know
who it was, I swear.
Of course not.
Then I got pregnant.
Burnett is 23 years old. She admits that soap opera's torturous plot twists are not exactly cool among her peers. None of her friends watch them.
I went on the computer, and I changed the paternity test results.
What? No, that's not true!
There was a time soap operas wielded wide cultural influence. Even people who could care less about them knew about Luke and Laura's wedding on General Hospital in 1981. Or when Bo kidnapped Hope from her wedding on Days of Our Lives.
No! Bo, let me go! Bo!
Since 1983, with a few breaks, Christian Alfonso has played Hope, all cheekbones and raven hair. Over the years, she's watched production budgets get halved, salaries chopped, and the end of filming on location.
How nostalgic are you for the days when you would wear $35,000 wedding dresses?
Oh, my gosh. It was a big adjustment at first because, seriously, that is your first stop in the morning is wardrobe.
That used to mean designer dresses. Now, Alfonso says, Target. Part of how soap operas are trying to adapt to a new era has to do with how they're written. When Days of Our Lives head writer Marlene McPherson started her career 20 years ago, storylines or arcs could work themselves out over a year. Now?
We'd like to be able to start telling stories that maybe, you know, we'd do a week arc, that it only goes on for a week.
McPherson says these days people have shorter attention spans. She's banned the kind of scenes where actresses like Sarah Joy Brown talk to themselves to explain what's going on.
You used to have to do exposition for half of your episode.
Brown acted on As the World Turns, General Hospital, and The Bold and the Beautiful before joining Days of Our Lives last year.
These were the rules, that we had to repeat the same things we said the day before. They were certain that the audiences were not going to get it if you didn't.
NBC's strategy these days has changed.
Like, if they miss something, too bad, you missed it. You better crawl around the internet and try to find it. And they will, and they'll find it.
Creating stronger online fan communities and deeper engagement with the show is another way Days is trying to survive. Days of Our Lives executive producer, Ken Corday, is the son of the couple who created Days of Our Lives back in 1965. He says soaps used to be leaders in addressing social issues. They featured the first interracial couple on TV and the first abortion. Now they play it safe.
You don't deal with politics, conservative or liberal. You don't deal with abortion, being pro or con. These are just no-nos. They're not going to get us any audience.
Also out, those over-the-top storylines about demon possession that goosed ratings in the 1990s. Days is safe until the fall of 2013. That's when its contract expires. Its Nielsen ratings have stunk, even more than usual recently, but people at the show are convinced that Nielsen does not accurately reflect its reach. And maybe they have a point.
I love your swagger, Don. I love your swagger on the show.
At a huge fan event for Days of Our Lives in Los Angeles, nobody talked about watching it at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on NBC. They watch it after work, on weekends, online, and on a cable channel that mainly airs soap opera reruns.
I'm thankful for SoapNet.
Yeah,
I work during the day and I don't have time to watch it, so I stay up until 12 midnight to watch it.
Bad news for Days of Our Lives fan Deborah Falenga. SoapNet is going off the air this week. It's becoming instead a Disney-themed cable channel for children. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
Thank you. like sounds through your clock radio. So is NPR News.
There's a movie coming out this week based on a wildly popular novel. It's about teenagers in a dystopian society fighting to the death on TV. If you think I'm talking about The Hunger Games, you're wrong. It's a movie called Battle Royale, a hit in Japan 12 years ago. This week, the DVD is released in the U.S. Here's NPR's Netta Ulibi.
Among the admittedly select group of people who like both Japanese movies and young adult fiction, it's been a burning question.
Did Suzanne Collins knock off Battle Royale to write Hunger Games?
Grady Hendrix happens to be a young adult author and an expert in Asian film. He's read the interviews where Suzanne Collins has flatly denied knowing about Battle Royale before she wrote The Hunger Games. He says the plots are eerily similar. Battle Royale is about a bunch of school kids picked by lottery
who are in a near-future society taken to an island to be part of a game show.
Much like The Hunger Games.
Where they are fitted with explosive collars and told that they now are each going to be given a weapon ranging from paper fans to Uzis.
Also like The Hunger Games.
And they're released onto the island and they have to kill each other until there's only one left.
Sound like Hunger Games?
I like The Hunger Games fine. I couldn't help but make the comparison to Battle Royale.
Grady Hendrix thinks Battle Royale is better than The Hunger Games. Anne McKnight was afraid to see it for years due to its ultra-violent reputation. She teaches Japanese film at UCLA.
I'm not a big horror person myself, but I did finally go to see it, and I was really pleasantly surprised because it wasn't the sort of nihilistic bloodbath that I had expected.
McKnight is a fan of Battle Royale's director. He's best known for a series of gangster movies, kind of a Japanese version of The Wire. With Battle Royale, she was surprised by its even-handed gender politics.
Girls were imagined to be just as vicious as boys, and not just in the sort of backroom gossip and catfight mode, but out-and-out violent.
The violence in Battle Royale is not gratuitous, says Grady Hendrix. Again, like The Hunger Games, he says it's intended to be a jolting parable about war. And director Kenji Fukasaku survived World War II.
When he was 15 years old, he worked in a munitions factory in Japan during the war. It was bombed a lot, and one of his jobs at the age of 15 was to take a wheelbarrow around the factory and pick up body parts after bombing raids.
That left Fukasaku with a deep abhorrence of war and a profound sense of betrayal by grown-ups. That lasted into his own adulthood, and it fueled his decision to film Battle Royale with sweet-faced teenagers wreaking mayhem on each other to a soundtrack by Verdi. In 2000, when Battle Royale was released in Japan, it was both highly controversial and a massive blockbuster, in spite of the fact that young teenagers were not allowed to see it. And that irritated the director.
So he gave a very famous statement to the press where he said, "Kids, if you've got the courage, you can sneak in, and I encourage you to do so."
Grady Hendrix appreciated how The Hunger Games book was gory and disturbing. Like Battle Royale, it's supposed to communicate war's horrors to young teenagers. Hendrix worries The Hunger Games movie will tone down the violence and make it exciting.
The line between making violence graphic and upsetting and making violence graphic and cool is a very narrow one.
Hendrix says one of the most important things Battle Royale and The Hunger Games share is the idea of teenagers trapped in a ruined society, coerced by grown-ups into doing horrible things. Even so, they both make clear there's nothing more utopian than a teenager, even in a dystopia. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
The AMC series Mad Men, winner of the Best Drama Series Emmy for each of its four seasons to date, returns with Season 5 this Sunday after a 17-month hiatus. Our TV critic David Biancooley asks whether the long-overdue start of this new season was worth the wait, and starts by answering that very question.
Yes, it was worth the wait. Absolutely. Mad Men returns Sunday with a 2-hour season premiere. And by the time it's over, if you react the way I did, you'll be satisfied and even comforted to have spent two wonderful hours with the folks at Sterling Cooper Draper Price. Series creator Matthew Weiner has created something magical with Mad Men, and that magic spell continues in Season 5. This show has a pace and feel all its own, and the writers, actors, and directors all attack with the cocky confidence of John Hamm's Don Draper entering a conference room to woo a new client. These characters have been delineated so richly over the years that spending time with them this season is not only a pleasure, it's a constant series of small but revealing discoveries. When Elizabeth Moss, as Peggy, snaps at Don after she has a bit too much to drink, it's underplayed, but it's obviously a bold move that results in a series of aftershocks. So is the power play by Vincent Kartheiser's Pete, who's bringing in more clients than many others in the office, and doesn't want that fact to go unnoticed or unrewarded. Secrecy and mystery are big parts of Mad Men, especially between seasons, so there's no point in getting specific here. Yes, as usual, the new season begins sometime after the previous season ended, allowing the plot to jump ahead a bit, but I won't say how long. Nor will I say what most Mad Men fans seem to want to know. Did Don really marry Megan, the secretary to whom he proposed, impulsively and quite shockingly, in the fourth season finale? And if you remember that proposal, you really are a fan, because that was televised way back in 2010. All I'll say is that Megan still is a part of Don's life, and they appear at first to be getting along quite well. That's true at work, where Don, played by John Hamm, takes the opportunity to ditch Pete Campbell and meet with Megan, played by Jessica Paré, in his office behind closed doors, at which point he immediately embraces her.
Let's get out of here.
No.
Then lock the door.
As soon as I'm in here longer than 5 minutes, people start to...
What? Who?
I have to get these to Peggy. I have a presentation, you know.
I can make you go home right now, you know. I have that power.
Mr. Campbell is here to see you.
I just saw him.
I have to get back to work.
Open your blouse.
You're a dirty old man. Anything else?
No, ma'am.
I'm sorry, am I interrupting?
Megan and Don also appear to be getting along outside of work, but appearances can be deceiving. Don may be calm and carefree on the surface, but he's always churning underneath. Season 5 begins with him facing his 40th birthday, and a surprise party, at which Megan, as a special gift, joins the band that's been hired for the party, grabs a microphone, and sings a pretentious little song in French while giving him the 1960s equivalent of a lap dance. Because it's Don Draper, it's impossible to register his true reaction, but it'll come out sooner or later. Once again, here's Jessica Paré as Megan.
1, 2, 3, 4. Qu'ils sont doux. Zoubi, zoubi, zou.
The opening hours of Mad Men this season are about office politics and personal relationships. But the world that's percolating outside, at this point in the 60s, can't be held at bay for long. And it isn't. Mad Men is a show devoted to its era and determined to strip away any undeserved nostalgia. So race, war, and drugs all come into play. But Mad Men also is about our times, and the timeless ebb and flow of intimate relationships, professional status, and secret yearnings. Mad Men, even after such a long hibernation, is a show for all seasons. It's great to have it back, and it's as great as ever.
David Biancooley is founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching and teaches TV and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Fred Snyder, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Well, the stylish, womanizing, hard-living folks at Sterling Cooper Draper Price are back. The highly anticipated return of Mad Men premieres this Sunday night on AMC after a hiatus of 17 months. As NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports, the creator of the series about advertising in the 60s has a pretty good idea how to sell his show in 2012.
First, why has Mad Men been off the air so long?
Where the hell have you been?
What's the problem?
Don,
can you give me a minute?
I don't mind waiting.
AMC says they wanted to do a little program shuffle, so they ran Breaking Bad last summer and saved Mad Men for this spring. Makisha Madden, TV writer for the Detroit News, says Mad Men is the reason AMC even has other shows.
Breaking Bad and Walking Dead and The Killing, all of these shows are, in large part, are successful because they started off with one really successful show in Mad Men.
For a while, it was unclear whether Mad Men would come back at all. When it came time for creator Matthew Weiner to renew his contract, he says there were some sticking points, including product placement.
Heineken is one of our clients.
Since Mad Men is a show about advertising, Matthew Weiner says,
I have to use real products in the show, so a lot of the opportunities for product placement have actually been generated by me.
Weiner says it was easy to write the Dutch beer Heineken into an entire episode.
For women entertaining in the home, Holland is Paris. They can buy this sophisticated beer and proudly walk it into the kitchen instead of hiding it in the garage.
Weiner says Heineken paid for that placement, but he says some brands do not give them money.
Don bought a Cadillac, and Cadillac was not involved in that. They would not have allowed Betty Draper to vomit in their car.
It's been almost a year and a half since Mad Men was on the air.
The first thing I thought of is like, oh my God, people aren't going to see the show for that long.
So how will he and AMC get them back? To refresh people's minds, AMC is airing repeats of previous seasons. And of course, they're advertising, like running billboards of the evocative Falling Man image and airing commercials during some of AMC's most popular shows.
Walking Dead fans, Mad Men is for you.
Making Sunday's premiere 2 hours instead of one is also a way Matthew Weiner hopes to bring fans back.
I'm not going to amp the story up to an unrealistic level. I'm not going to, like, you know, start off with a fire in the agency and say who survived. But I did want to give at least something extra. So that's, first of all, was the decision to make a 2-hour premiere.
If you could have any client in the world, who would you want?
American Airlines.
Why?
Because they stood us up.
Right.
Who's going to sleep with whom? Will Don Draper reveal his past? Will Peggy Olson outdo the men? Matthew Weiner has been notoriously tight-lipped.
He won't talk.
Jerry Delafamina was a titan on Madison Avenue for decades. One of his books about the business partly inspired Mad Men. Delafamina says Weiner's secrecy is great PR.
You don't even have an idea where he's going with the show. So they've already got you wondering.
Delafamina says he wants the series to continue showing how the tumult of the 1960s affected the advertising industry. He also wants to see Don Draper loosen up.
I mean, Don Draper's got to stop feeling bad for sleeping with women. He's just got to snap out of it. You know, he's doing it. He's good at it. Stop feeling guilty, for crying out loud.
Wow. I love Jerry. He just says a lot of things out loud that really completely clarify the entire period.
A period of such decadence? Delafamina says he's surprised he's still alive. Mad Men indeed. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.